Hey, good evening, everybody. This is Jim Hoffman for EMS Office Hours, and I am joined by
Josh Knapp. It's every week I join you, Jim. Almost exactly. Every week. I bounce out every now and then.
Yeah, that's okay. We all have lives to live.
So before we get into the show, I have a question for you. You ever see The Day After Tomorrow?
Yeah, I think so.
Why is it? What was it? Dennis Quaid and who else?
Yeah, I've seen that.
You know, about the weather. New York freezes over. So where's EMS and all that? We just don't get representation.
We're blended with everything else. You know that. It's assumed.
It's assumed. It's assumed. The ambulance will be there. It's assumed. Okay.
Well,
yeah. All right.
Those movies.
I just want to make that clear.
Well, people don't have heart attacks in those movies. Everybody's, you either die or you live. And if you get injured, then you get some kind of makeshift, you get a makeshift sling or, they stop the bleeding with a roll of newspaper, a stack of newspapers or something.
Right. Or they do the tracheostomy with the pen.
Right. Exactly.
Or the cricoid thoracic.
Everyone's trained in those movies, right? Everybody's familiar with, that type of first aid and how to adapt to help people in those types of emergencies. It's the rest of the time that nobody can figure out what to do.
Like when the zombies are running after them, they don't know what to do. They sort of fall,
Exactly.
Oh my, all of a sudden I have to run slow, or I can't put the key in the car and get away.
Yeah. Also, it's also those movies, even the zombie, but the zombie movies too, those are the same things where the people in the movies, they know how to, stop the gunshot wound, put a tourniquet on, stitch wounds up, It's when it's not the zombie apocalypse or a mini ice age that nobody can figure out, what to do.
So you're saying it depends on the theme of the movie, how intelligent the public is in handling a disaster or an emergency.
No, it's pretty much all movies, they know how to handle it. All movies know how to handle it, except for the movies where it's based on EMS. Then they don't, because the EMS has to do their job. Otherwise, they got to pay people to be paramedics and EMTs in these movies and have ambulances and all that stuff. And who's paying for that?
Well, they pay for fire trucks. I don't think
police
cars.
And fire. They've got the police and fire. Fire trucks are dramatic. It's a big truck. A bunch of people jump off of it. They've got sticks and bottles and tanks and fancy masks and helmets.
So you're saying basically that we don't get credit. EMS doesn't get credit because we're not interesting.
Yeah, it's not exciting enough, That's the problem. And then on top of it not being exciting enough, a lot of the stuff that we do, we can't show some of the reality of what we do.
Well, that's for sure.
We can't show it. I think some people would. Because I think the element there of there's an element there of people who will say, we're just dragging people to the hospital. Don't need to go. Or there's an element there of people that will say, we might appear callous. On calls. You know, so you get that, you get a little bit of that, I guess, that, to the point, I think, where they're not ready to know the truth of it. Now listen, think about how many people you talk to that are outside of EMS. You tell them what you do, and well, you try to describe all you did to them, right? To me, when I've been passed, they never really 100% get it. Well, they don't get where I'm coming from. You know, they view it as maybe being negative towards the job, or they view it as being callous towards the patient.
Right. Or trying to
Right.
act cool about it because, we all know that aloof, sort of disinterested affect is the cool person affect. So we don't
Yeah.
want to, we give that impression. But,
Yeah.
I actually had a friend of mine. I got one of those drippy, letters. So, EMS prayer of, I wish you knew what I experienced when I'm
Yeah.
digging, a teenager out of a car, blah, blah, blah. And, it sort of hit me at the right time, right place. And so I did a thing which I don't usually do, which is I forwarded it on an email. And I hate when that people do that, generally speaking, unless it's something really good. And I thought at the time, mea culpa, I thought it was good. I had a friend of mine who is a mother of four children email me back, "What the blank are you sending me this crap for? I don't want to hear it. I don't want to know what you do. You just come and you get us if we're in trouble. That's it." And I'm like, "Holy crap." And I thought, that's it. They don't want to know. And half the time, I think getting into some of this stuff, our patients don't want to know either. Half the time, I think there are sometimes they genuinely are concerned or they're genuinely interested in what's going on. But you know what? We cannot, it's funny because you ask that question, can you lie to a patient? And that brings up so much of that, like that emotional content of EMS that goes against the grain of what we were told we should be and what we should do. We've always got to play the straight and narrow. We've got to suck it up and, help everybody because we're called to their aid, regardless of they're the homeless drunk or they're abusing, frequent flyer abusing the system or the grandma who's just scared of the lightning storm. We
Yeah.
have to go and we have to, show that professional face and go and do our job. And you have
Sure.
been. You've been, listen, you've been on, those threads and those comments on the blogs and stuff about how people go off. They go nuts. And that's people who are working theoretically EMS, or
Yeah.
better yet, bring up the whole thing about volunteerism. So this strikes the same chord. Should you lie to a patient? Oh my God, what do you
Yeah.
mean? How could you? That's like not giving oxygen. Well, actually, the words I say, unless I choose them very unwisely and the person's really unstable, oxygen is usually a better therapy. Although the words you can say can be as potent at either helping or hindering their emergent need.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, Josh, I think I have a caller here. Let me bring them in, and before we get going, this way maybe we can just get their opinion off the top there. Hi, caller. Who's with us?
Hello.
Tim, is that
Hello.
you?
Yep.
Hey, Tim, how you doing?
Okay.
Hey, Jimmy, how you doing, man?
I'm doing fine. Or I could be lying.
I tell you, it's funny,
I prefer if you lie to me. Wait. Listen, can I tell you the truth on this?
I don't know. Can you?
I don't know. I love when people say that. Do you mind if I tell you the, do you mind if I tell you the truth? No,
Yeah.
please lie to me.
people who say that think that it improves our trust for them, and it's telling me that they're pretty assuming that everybody is lying to them all the time. And the reason people usually do that is because they're not all that honest themselves. Or they just grew up around somebody who uses that phrase a lot.
What do you think, Jim?
I don't know. I'm getting confused. I don't know who's telling the truth anymore.
Now, here's the question. When we, you know, the trouble is with a lie, you know, you always dig yourself deeper, and you don't always get to back out. So the question is, you know, is it okay to tell a patient a lie?
It depends.
Yeah, I agree. I think it depends too. I like to lie by omission.
Yeah, I prefer not to tell a lie because, you know, once you start lying, as you said, you keep digging yourself deeper. You have to remember each lie you said, why you said it, and the ways it may complicate how you deal with the patient. It's much easier to deal with the truth. And rather than lying to the patient, you can say, I don't know. We're very uncomfortable saying, I don't know. We act like we're supposed to know everything. I don't know everything. I don't know anybody who knows everything.
Yeah, that's
Jim
true. I mean,
everything.
I know everything. I know a little bit about everything. I know about everything.
How can
but,
you
know,
make
I mean,
such great testing software if you didn't know everything, Jim? Come on, just fess up.
You know,
say
of,
you know everything.
That stuff. You know what it is, though, Josh, is I mean, you guys both make a good point. You start to lie, and then you end up getting to a point where you kind of dig yourself in a hole. And I mean, you get to a point even when you get to the hospital, and the patient will say something and say, oh, the paramedic told me this. And the nurse would be like, no, that's not happening, or that's not what's going on, you know. And then right away, now you start looking bad in front of the nurses and the doctors because you lied to the patient for whatever the reason may be. Maybe you wanted to keep them calm in the back of the ambulance. Maybe you didn't want to upset them. Maybe it just wasn't something you wanted to start getting into with them. You know, some patients will ask open-ended questions to the point where you don't want to have a full-blown conversation with them back there about, you know, some minute part of what they're going through. You know, so you kind of just kind of brush it off and maybe lie a little bit just to kind of end that line of questioning almost. I mean, have you ever done that type of thing?
You know, it was kind of what I think Timmer said earlier. It's a lie through omission. Or, you know, it's not lying through omission. You know, I've heard that spin both ways. You know, it's if you are telling somebody something, and we're not talking about patient care, we're just talking about general life, and you leave out some pertinent fact that would address or talk about, you know, what you're talking about, you know, address what you're talking about and change the facts or clarify the facts, that everybody agrees is a lie of omission. Now,
right.
You know what? At the same time, we sort of stretch that to EMS and say, well, if you don't tell somebody they're having a serious, serious heart attack, it's a lie of omission. And the truth of the matter is it, and I want to just throw this back at him, is it really a lie of omission? Because is that the truth? Do you know they're having a serious heart attack and could die? Or is that just what your experience has told you? So, in fact, you really don't know what the outcome will be. You don't know how this person is really, you know, like, as absolute fact, is going to come through this situation. So why not leave out a detail that's only going to add stress to them, and you don't really know what the truth is? Is that a lie of omission?
Well, what if the patient asks you specifically about something, and you say, I don't know. They may do this at the hospital, but I have no control over what they do at the hospital. because there will be times when something that I expect to be done routinely on every patient with the same presentation, I bring them in and they do things differently.
That is true too, though. That is something you have to be careful of. Again, that's the type of thing where you might think you know, you have a patient. I mean, I've had patients that complain of, let's say, chest pain or even, you know, our favorite, you know, neck and back pain from, you know, a motor vehicle accident. You have them on a board and collar. And, you know, some patients you bring in and they take them right off the board and collar. And other patients, they leave them sitting on the board and the doc won't take them off until they have x-rays done.
Right.
You know, so you never know. And even with chest pain patients, some patients you bring in, you know that it's not a cardiac related chest pain from your experience, your assessment. You feel it's more pleuritic, or you feel it's maybe anxiety,
or
something like
that.
We never
know that it is or is not.
Right, but
we,
what I'm saying is, when you get to the hospital, though, they
change
it up.
But we do not know.
Well, let me address sort of let me address something that's entirely. That's tangential to this entire discussion.
Holy
and this
crap.
Is the thing. This is the thing that actually you said before, Jim, is that it's very, and you said it offhand, and I'm wondering if you really know why you said it, but it's very important that we tell the truth, or at least appear to be honest and straightforward with the patient. And, you know, somebody listening to this can say, well, what the hell? Why should I bother? I'm going to be with them half an hour. I'm going to be with them an hour. I'm going to be with them 2 hours. Whatever. That time period after I do my transport, they're in the hospital. That's done and over. And, you know, if I lied to the patient, so be it, because I'm never going to see this person again. But the reason
why
it's so –
What if you do when you see them in court?
I don't even care if I see him again. I'll be honest with you, Tim. That's not
the
point here.
No, I mean in court.
Oh, wait. If you do, as long as they're not the opposing attorney, you know, what's the harm? But I'm going to – the harm is not if you see them in court. The harm is our presentation as a body of EMS to the public. And if one person sits there and says, those bastards in the ambulance, they don't tell you anything, they lie through their teeth, you know, I went in, I thought I had a broken leg, and it turned out I had, you know, 6 weeks in the hospital, we'll never recover from that. And I think that is why it's so important that we are careful with what we use as the truth and what we tell a patient.
But there's also a problem with what the patients perceive. And you can tell them everything and be as honest as possible at the time you're telling it. And they perceive things as being different from the way you told them. And you're telling the truth, and their memory or perception of the events at the time is entirely different, and that I think is common with our patients.
Yeah.
Because they don't understand what we do, they don't understand what we're doing, and even if we explain it to them as we're doing it to them, do everything, you know, the ideal way, the way the most progressive, you know, hold their hand kind of person wants to do it, you're still going to have a lot of patients who misunderstand what you said to them. This is often one of the most stressful times of their lives. So that's going to mess with their memories.
Sure.
And
well, that's true, but it also sharpens some memories. I mean, some of the most vivid memories of patients are us, you know, our EMS transport.
Yeah, accurate memories. Very often.
I think most of the memories are negative memories of what they remember more of.
On memory shows that we recreate our memories based on little bits of stuff that we think we remember. It's not like playing a movie. We recreate the memories from little bits that we remember. So how much distortion happens each time we remember it?
It's like playing phone.
Yeah, I'm... You know, look, the whole argument of what we remember, what we perceive, and how we perceive it is, you know, a good argument to have, but not. I don't think it's germane to what we're talking about right now, and because we have to assume that there. With the patient, there's going to be certain memories that are going to be created, and it's based on those interactions that there's either a positive or negative spin on those memories. I absolutely agree with you, Tim. You know, and there a lot of people, when they're in a time of panic or a time of emergency, everything gets distorted. Timelines get distorted. Facts get distorted. What the memory, I mean, the gorilla in the room, you know, that nobody sees. But I think that if we deal with the majority of them.
40% of the people don't see it. You know, most of the people do see it, but you have a significant portion of people who are just completely oblivious because they're so focused on something else. And I think that happens to us even though we are experienced. Something distracts us and we don't notice something really obvious. I've had that happen to me with patients, like, they told me what? Really? They told me they were diabetic? And it's something that's obvious, and it's part of your basic assessment, and if at that time you're distracted by something else, you can completely miss it.
Yeah, no, I absolutely, look, there's no argument that emergencies distort perception and distort memory. But there's also, I mean, how many times have you heard feedback from somebody that you helped, were conscious through the time that you helped them? I'm not talking about these ones where you pick them up, they're unconscious, and you bring them to the hospital and you help save them. I'm talking about people that, you know, the diabetic emergency or the asthma call or the sick call, whatever it is, you know, the trauma in the minor trauma in a car accident where you take really, you know, you take good care of somebody, you have a good interaction, they're appreciative of what you did, you know, and then you hear back later on. I mean, yes, you hear back too few and far between, but occasionally you do. And occasionally it's a very positive event for that person. You know, the event itself. Go ahead.
The wires.
Well, I'm saying if we get away from that. But, well, you know what? It's nothing that a few cc's of a few milligrams of morphine, yes, I brought that up, can't help.
Put the smile on their face, and that's why I have a smiley face on my blog.
It's true, though. It is true, though. I'm lying to you, but I'm lying to put a smile on your face and make this as painless for everybody as possible.
And with morphine, if I don't get orders and it's something where I need orders or I need orders to keep giving more, one of the options I have available to me is that we have syringes of saline that look similar to the morphine. Or I can draw some saline out of somewhere into the morphine syringe and pretend that I am giving morphine. It is a placebo effect, but
that's Jim's favorite drug.
It is a placebo, but it is also the only option I have for pain management at the time. And if I am able to get the patient to believe I'm giving them more morphine, then maybe it will help decrease the pain.
Now, let me ask you something, Tim. And something like that. Okay, you're in essence, I guess, you're lying to the patient, right? But now, do you when you get to the hospital, do you tell them that that had that effect?
Oh, yeah. If I don't tell them, then I can expect that there will be some complication, because the only way I would not have got the orders is by calling and asking for them. So if the patient then tells the doctor, oh, thank you for giving the order for morphine, and the doctor specifically told me, do not give morphine, if I have told them that, I'm just asking for, you know, a bad outcome of the sort. Now, well, I may tell the doctor outside the room, you know, I generally try to give report about certain things out of the patient's hearing, you know, or I'll write a note and put it in front of the nurse when I'm in between the patient and the nurse and, you know, just tap at it until the nurse looks at it and, you know, acknowledges it. That way the information is communicated because they need to know what I'm giving. With morphine, it really doesn't matter because the only way to give morphine is to titrate to effect. So if I've given 100 milligrams or if I've given 0 milligrams, if they're going to give more morphine or if they're going to give dilaudid, does the amount that I've given affect how much they give? Not really.
You know, there's another way to skin that cat as well, is that you don't have to say, I'm giving you morphine right now, when that's a plain and clear mistruth. You know, you can, but you know it's going to have a placebo effect. It's the, what do you call this, 5 cc's of life?
You give 5 cc's of life.
Right. But the other aspect that you could look at it and just say, you know what,
I'm giving you something.
I'm giving you something that should make you feel better. And that's what I usually say. You know, let me give you something here. It should make you feel better.
I have no problem with that. But if I have been giving morphine and I've reached the maximum dose that I can give on standing orders, and they're expecting to get more, some patients don't want to know what I'm giving them. I say, I can give you some pain medicine, and some say, yes, please give me something. Others say, well, what do you want to give me? And they're uncomfortable. The patient I had today did not want morphine. But as we got farther along, the pain got worse, and he said, yes, please give me the morphine. Now, he's had morphine before. He didn't like the feeling, but the pain became bad enough that he said, I'm willing to put up with the side effects that I don't like. And, you know, unfortunately, we don't have fentanyl because of the drug shortage. But I, you know, with some patients, I will tell them exactly what I'm giving them. Some patients don't want to know, and you know, as long as they don't have an allergy, and I'll double-check the allergies before giving them anything, then they don't necessarily need to know what I'm giving them. I don't explain necessarily why I'm giving a bunch of nitroglycerin to somebody who's got CHF, because they're not having a real good conversation with me at the time.
Yeah, I mean, but, you know, at the same time, you wouldn't do that with another. We're talking pain management, and we all know that the placebo, the patient's mental status has a great deal to do with how pain management works. Now, the question is, you know, that's lying about, or, you know, or mistruth about, is there a difference between mistruth and lying? But you wouldn't do it with any other drug. I certainly wouldn't give somebody saline and say it was albuterol.
With Maddox, what I like to do, as long as they're relatively stable, is alternate between a nebulizer of albuterol and then a nebulizer, the next one being just saline. And I don't necessarily tell them that it is albuterol, but it's one of the things that an old medical director recommended. He said, you know, you don't want to give them too much albuterol. As long as they're responding to the first one and they, you know, their SAT is up and their breathing is improved, you can give them another nebulizer, but now you're just giving them saline to keep moisturizing the lungs to try to mobilize the mucus plugs in there and help them to cough that up and clear out their lungs. You're providing an effective therapy. It's not just a placebo, but you're also not getting another patient surprise was a transfer who was on huge dose of albuterol, and they didn't have labs back at the sending hospital. When we got down to the children's hospital, the patient's potassium was very low. So there can be side effects that giving a lot of albuterol can cause a problem with.
Yeah, but, you know, there's a difference between doing something and working in the back of the bus and just doing stuff and telling the patient that you're giving them something that they're familiar with when you're not giving that. You know,
yeah.
That, I mean, you wouldn't go to a patient and say, you know, I'm giving you albuterol right now and give them saline.
I might if I had a good reason to withhold the albuterol. If they're having headaches or tremors, you know, this is something that is more than they usually have, and it's a sign that maybe there's something else going on, and their lungs don't appear to be the problem, but they're saying, I need the albuterol.
The main reason you would do that is because of what you just said. Their lungs aren't, you know, we base the treatment of albuterol based on lung sounds. You know, are we hearing wheezing? Are we hearing air movement? Are we hearing all the things necessary that we would need otherwise to treat with albuterol or other medications? And what I'm basically saying is, under a scenario where a patient needed something, you wouldn't give them something else and tell them, no, it's not that. I mean, that just is, that's beyond lying.
Unless it's something where I can't get orders, you know, like morphine, fentanyl, benzodiazepines, something where I would need orders, that would be the reason for it. Usually with an asthmatic, I go a lot more by what the patient tells me they think they need than by the lung sounds and everything else, because they're the expert on their lungs. I'm just using that as an example of one case where I have not told the patient, yes, I'm giving you albuterol and giving them the saline, but it's a possibility. I can imagine the kind of patient where I just haven't had to.
So what are we walking away with at this point here? I'm a little confused. Is it okay to lie to the patients? Is their knowledge not that important?
Well
I think, like Jim said, I think it depends, right?
Yeah.
It depends on what, Jim?
I guess it depends upon the patient and, you know, what they're presenting with. I mean, and what you as a provider, I suppose, is getting from them and your assessment to them. I mean, there's two scenarios that I think of when it comes to this. I'd like to get your take on it. And the one is the one I mentioned in the show notes about a patient having a heart attack and the 12-lead, you know, showing you all kinds of elevation, and they're presenting as a classic, you know, signs and symptoms of having an MI, and they're asking you if they're having a heart attack. I mean, do you tell them, yes, you're having a heart attack, or do you try to not tell them to increase their stress levels? You know, something like in that situation, what's the more appropriate thing to do? Do you tell them, yes, you are? Do you tell them, I'm not sure, it's going to take blood work, it's going to take, you know, more EKGs and things like that to, you know, before we know 100%? Or do you tell them, yes, I believe you are having one?
I tell them, yes, I think you are.
Really?
Why would I?
I got to say something. You know, we're sort of, you know, we know the power of stress in a cardiac situation, and one of the treatments we're supposed to do is, besides put them in a position of comfort, have them not exert themselves, is not stress them more. I mean, you know, that type of, if you're brutally honest with a patient, sometimes that brutal handling can cause damage.
Well, I tell them, I think you're having a heart attack, but this is what we can do for you. And this is what they are going to continue in the hospital. They will reassess. They will do some blood work. Patient asks me, am I going to die today? I tell them I don't think so. They ask me, am I going to die? I tell them everybody dies.
Right. And there's where, and that's what, Tim, I didn't mean to be that hard on you, but that's really where I was going with that. You're going to shape it. You're not going to hit them in the head with it and say, you know what, you're going to fucking die. Get over it. Yes. Oh, my God, it's the big one. I've never seen anything that worse. Put on the lights and sirens. I don't know if we'll make it to the hospital in time.
You want to turn the monitor on and start rolling your eyes.
Yeah, I'm calling ahead to St. Peter for medical command. Do we divert to the warm place, or?
Yeah. I think we should just go straight to the funeral home, give up right now.
I tell them that I think they're having a heart attack if they ask, and I tell them what I'm going to do and why it should work, and once I start giving them nitrates, if that doesn't work, then I add in morphine or fentanyl. And they're already getting whatever amount of oxygen is appropriate. And by the time I get to the hospital,
21%,
most of them,
you can breathe.
depends on what their SAT is. If their SAT is above 95, there is no benefit from the supplemental oxygen.
But you're still going to give supplemental oxygen. Come on.
Yeah.
I mean, well, we can't get it. Let's not get it.
There is no possible harm. Why am I giving supplemental oxygen? Is the oxygen in the nose getting to the coronary muscle anymore with a higher, by raising the saturation from, say, 96 to 97? Am I making any difference? Only
do you want
in the
me to answer that?
At the billing.
Do you really want me to answer that? Because I'll give you the answer. The answer is it's the standard of care. And I know that you may
have done research. Actually, it's not the standard of care. If you look at the Heart Association guidelines, it says no.
Says no to supplemental oxygen?
Says as long as that is above 95.
Above 90, yeah, I just... Well, I think Joffrey, you mean though too, is not. I mean, standard of care as far as I guess certain protocols and a lot of regions still tell you to give 100% oxygen to chest pain patients regardless of what their O2 set is.
That's different from the standard of care for everyone, because if you're looking at the Heart Association guidelines as the standard of care, that's quite a bit different from local protocols in some places.
Right. Yeah,
well,
I mean, I have American Heart Association, like you said, Tim. American Heart says, as far as the 95%, but then my local protocol says, chest pain patients, get oxygen,
It doesn't matter how high their SAT is, they're getting supplemental oxygen. If they're cyanotic, they're getting supplemental oxygen. But other than that, what is the benefit? There is harm from too much oxygen.
Yeah, but you're not going to have harm over the short term. You may have harm over several days, but you're not going to have harm over the short term.
Short term harm, yes. There is research on
this. There's research on it, but there's nothing definitive that has come out that says don't give oxygen.
Back on the supplemental oxygen? It's because they're convinced that the evidence is greater that there is harm than the evidence of any kind of benefit. If they felt that there was more possibility of benefit than harm, then they would say, yes, if supplemental oxygen. Since they feel that the evidence of harm is greater, they say, no, please don't do that because that's not a good thing. Even short term, you are likely to harm the patient.
I tell you, the funny thing is with that, I'll tell you, is I knew a little bit about that before I took my last ACLS class, and it's funny that a lot of the people in the class were getting that question that was on the exam wrong when they phrased it as far as giving supplemental oxygen and the saturation percentages. And a lot of people were getting that wrong because they're so fixated on the way that we've been doing things when it comes to oxygen administration on every patient gets a Nari breather type thing, you know. So it's hard, I think, to go with that when you're so used to doing it the other way and your protocols are telling you to do it that way. So it's like, well, it's not going to do me any harm if I do it. You know, it's just giving them oxygen. You know, yes, the American Heart says one thing, but my protocol says the other, and it's not going to do any harm to, you know, just give it to them on the way to the hospital.
You know, it's
we
like
don't
the old thing that
drug that is completely harmless.
Yeah.
Well, that's true.
And we don't carry stuff that's all that, well, that's not entirely true either.
Let me ask you this. I mean, you've got these patients, even you have, you know, like a patient like that. To me, on the chest pain thing, the heart attack thing, I'm the same type of way, I guess, to both the way you guys are. But I also measure it on the patient themselves. If I feel the patient, the way that they're talking and presenting to me, is not going to be too emotionally handle me telling them, yes, you are having a heart attack, I'll try to, you know, dance away from the question. Because I don't want to, again, like you said, Josh, I don't want to stress them out more by telling them, yes, they are, and getting their heart pumping faster and, you know, getting them more stressed out over the fact that they're having one. But you will have people who can handle the truth and handle it. And like Tim said, you handle the truth and you tell them what you can do for them and allow them to know, be part of the treatment that's going on.
Yeah, I'm not going all Jack Nicholson on them there.
No, but, and I wasn't inferring that you would. I don't think any good practitioner would do that. I think we all, right? You can't handle it. Pound them once or twice too, just to get it all going. You know, make it, bring it home. But you know what I'd like to do,
I would give it a 10.
Yeah.
What I like to do is handle things with a grain of a sense of humor, a little bit lightheartedness. You know, don't, even if the situation is really serious and I'm racking my brains and I'm trying to make sure I stay organized, get the next step and do it quickly, I try to act a little bit casual about everything. Like, you know, this is really what we do for everybody. And, you know, short of pulling out the pads. This is what we do for everybody. Listen, a lot of people call us for heart attacks. I've dealt with a lot of heart attacks, and there's all sorts of things. You know, I tell people nowadays, and I'm doing a transport to the cath lab, that these places, I say, have you ever been to a cath lab before? And sometimes they go, you know, a lot of them go, yes. I mean, I've been there. But a lot of them, I've never been there before, and I say, listen, you know what? These are big places for the hospital. They run them like Jiffy Lube. There's practically no waiting, and the only thing is you don't get an air freshener when you're done. You know?
I don't get an air freshener from Jiffy Lube.
Yeah, I was going to say, which one are you going to? I got to buy an air freshener from. I got to buy a lot of things from Jiffy Lube.
Well,
do
you get the executive oil change? Excuse me. You know, you got to get the, you know, and it has everything, including, you know, they refill all the fluids. Check
the rotation. Something
on the procedures. You're working on your tip.
Yeah, exactly.
Remember, so you guys serve for 20%.
So let me ask this other scenario, which I think, to me, lying is a little bit, can be a little bit worse, is the psych patients that you get that are in the back and they don't really agree that they're a psych patient, and they're asking what's going to happen. Am I going to go into the psych ward? Am I going to do this? Am I going to take my clothes off when I get there? And you tell them, no, you don't have to put a gown on, and no, you're not going to go to the psych area.
No.
You get
to the
hospital,
we're going to the emergency department. We're going to the emergency department. They're going to check them out. They're going to see what is causing what's going on. They're going to find a way to help them, and I have no control over where they go from there.
Yeah, but then they get to the hospital, and now they're being told to, you know, take their clothes off, they're going to put the gown on, or they go into the back room where they,
I don't
where
have
a lot of them
control
have been before.
Over what happens. I don't have any control over what happens in the hospital, and that's what I tell them.
Yeah, but you know that they're going to probably go there, so technically you're lying to them.
No,
and now they're going to freak out.
I am telling them that they're going to the emergency department, they're going to be medically screened, and anybody who goes straight to a psych ward without being medically screened, that's a bad idea. You need to get them checked out because whatever's going on with them could have a medical basis. It could be hypoglycemia. It could be that their electrolytes are off. It could be they have an infection. It could be that they've taken an overdose of something. It could be somebody slipped them something. We have no idea what's going on. We're taking them to the emergency department to get checked out.
Well, but we go back now, though, Tim, too, what we talked about early on, where you get some patients, where you bring psych patients or, you know, people who are having behavioral issues, and you get to the hospital, and you expect them to get, let's say, a medical workup, because you don't really know what's happening. You don't really know the cause of them, you know, having an episode, but yet they'll whisk them right to the psychiatric area. And then other times, they'll give a full medical workup.
That's why I also tell them that I have no control over what they do at the hospital. We're taking you to the emergency department to get checked out. What they do from there is up to them. I can't tell the doctor what to, well, I can tell the doctor what to do, but, you know, it's only when I want to see interesting expressions on the doctor's face.
We all can tell the doctor what to do. It's not going to go over too good, I don't think.
No, that's not the prescribed way of attacking that situation.
Although
but,
I like to take pictures of that, though. Maybe that could be a good series in the blog. Is I told the doctor this, and then you take a picture of the doc as you're telling him something, and you can post it on the blog.
Yeah, if you don't want to work too long at the place you're at,
doctor's expression looks like.
But this is sort of interesting. This is sort of addressing what I was saying before, Jim, is that, you know, you got to sort of dance. You got to do the dance. You can't just stay straight up. Yeah, you're going to the nut house, you know, or you're going to be going into psych and they're going to strap you down if you misbehave. You got to sort of say, listen, you know what, to be honest with you, can I be honest with you? That was the phrase I was looking for.
Yeah, I'm going to tell you the truth now.
But – I don't really know 100% what's going to go on. I mean, you know, you're with me because you're having this problem right now. We're going to the ED to figure it out. The docs there are there for you, and they're going to help you. So whatever, you know, we got to see this through, you shouldn't have to feel this. And usually for a psych situation, they're doing something or feeling something that's the reason they're seeking help. So I've told psych patients, look, you know, you're feeling horrible right now. You told me, and it's not like I'm putting words in their mouth. You told me you're feeling horrible right now. You've never felt so low. I understand. I want to help you. The people at the hospital want to help you. That's what we're going to do because you shouldn't have to feel this way.
Well,
and that's what we're going to do.
Telling them that I understand because one of the things that some people will respond with is, no, you don't understand how I'm feeling. And how do you explain to them that I understand exactly how you're feeling? I don't understand what somebody else is feeling.
Don't
give pain medicine. I don't understand that.
Don't jump on me saying I understand what you're saying. I'm saying that for the
conversation. But a lot of people use that terminology.
Okay, so
you have to be careful because it can yes. come back and bite you like that. I mean, that is a good point, you know.
I mean, listen,
the opposite phrasing. I say, I don't understand what's going on with you, but I do understand that it is something that you see as serious. And, you know, people hallucinating and stuff like that, I don't see what you're seeing, but I understand that you are seeing them. Yeah, how many people do you see in the room with me right now, and is there anything I should do? You know, am I sitting on somebody or, you know, work with them, but don't tell them that you're buying into what they're seeing. You know, tell them honestly
right.
what you're seeing. I don't see these people. You tell me you see people, I believe that that's what you're seeing. But I don't see them. And when we're taking people to the psych, or we think are going to go to the psych ward, what happens with the patients who actually do have a medical basis for what's going on? And we tell them, yeah, you're going to the psych ward, and it turns out they've got porphyria, or they've been slipped something by one of their coworkers, or something else.
Yeah.
And we tell them, yeah, you're going to the psych ward. I don't know where they're going. We're taking them to the emergency department to get checked out. If in the emergency department they ship them off automatically to the psych ward without checking them out, that's not my fault.
Yeah.
Well, and
I mean,
hopefully
that
you've
is
given
true.
A good enough story. If you suspect a medical problem or medical route to the psychological problem that you're addressing, you have to present that. And the emergency room is actually, you know, has some ownership to treat every underlying, I mean, it's a textbook, to treat every underlying psychological emergency as if there's an underlying medical cause.
I
mean, most protocols
not
tell you that.
Some of them will look at a patient and say, oh, yeah, I know what this is, and they do not do the full workup. Or maybe they start on it and they ship them over to psych before they've completed the full workup. And then later on they realize, hey, this came back as positive. You also have EMS do that. You get reports of people saying, don't worry, it's just indigestion. Malpractice lawyer's favorite sentence. Does that mean that it's just indigestion? Well, maybe 80% of the time it will be. But we're not going to hear about those.
Yeah. So let me ask you this real one quick other little thing, opinion I would like to know. Do you guys think that when it comes to, you know, lying or fibbing or stretching the truth or omitting the truth, however you want to phrase it, do you think that people that have been in EMS and have some experience kind of do it better than people that are brand new? Like the new people tend to be the ones that are more blunt and that won't lie to the patient. They feel, oh, I can't lie to the patient. I have to tell them the truth. I tell them everything. Whereas the more experienced provider might kind of, you know, hold back or phrase it more eloquently, I guess, and you know, present it to the patient in a way that won't stress them out, that won't elevate their anxiety, or if they're a psychiatric patient, you know, let's say it won't make them, you know, become violent or become uncooperative. You know what I mean? Whereas a newer provider just out of school might be more prone to just saying, okay, I don't lie to the patient. They told me in school, never lie to the patient. I'm telling the patient the truth. I don't care what's going on. And you hear them in the back of the ambulance telling the truth. You know, no matter what the patient asks, they'll go ahead and, you know, be 100% blunt about it. I mean, do you guys think that's the case?
Yeah, Jim, I'm going to reword that, and I'm going to say, do you think it's the case where rookies or new people in the field make the mistake of not reading the situation carefully enough or understanding the ramifications of what they do? And I think that's sort of where you get into the older EMS provider, the more experienced EMS provider is going to couch their words, carefully pick what they address and what they don't address, stress what they want to stress and de-stress the other aspect of what they're telling them. So maybe I don't have to lie to the patient, but I'm not going to get them riled up with the truth. And the other aspect is understand the limitations of what you know to be the truth. You don't know somebody's
right.
going to die. You know,
like Tim said, if you do, you know, sometimes in a lot of cases you really don't know what's happening. You're better off just telling them that than telling them what you think you know.
Right.
There are sometimes when you really need to avoid the question, like the patient who is very depressed and has been crying and then asks you, how do I look? And they've got nothing but mascara running down their face. And it's like, well,
you look like
that. They learned about that at the hospital. It's kind of like, do these pants make my butt look big? Like, there is no right answer.
There's no answer, period.
Not answering is not a right answer. It's just one of those traps where it's like the end of a video game. There, you know, Kobayashi Maru. You know, there is no way out without cheating. It's like, okay, shoot her now. Your Honor, she has the pants on, her butt look big.
Yeah. I'm so glad my wife doesn't listen to this podcast. I'm just so glad.
Yeah. It makes her butt big?
I don't want that getting out of the podcast.
Hey, there's a reason I'm single.
This podcast makes your butt big.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, there's a reason I'm single.
How about another way of looking at it? You know, am I having a big heart attack? Perhaps, but you don't have to worry about your butt looking big.
Yeah.
Deflect him. Push him to another thing entirely.
Right. Listen, why don't we end it there, guys? I just want to mention the EMS Web Summer coming up before we run out of time, because I want to try to give everyone an opportunity to make sure they go register. It's a free registration for this all-day webcast event coming up. It's May 17th. That's going to be a Thursday. It's from 10 a.m. till about 8 p.m. We've got 13 speakers and 14 topics. And Tim Noonan, you're one of the speakers, going to be joining us. Talking about Epi in the field, and I'm looking forward to that session you're going to do. We've got Bob Page going to be.
Epinephrine.
What's that?
The soothing effects of epinephrine.
Yes, exactly. We got Bob Page is going to join us as well. Peter Canning, Dan Limmer, Greg Fries will be there. A whole bunch of lists of great speakers and great topics. If you want more information, go to emswebsummit.com. You can register free there. There's also some videos there and some of the areas telling you as an attendee how you can get in and what to expect once you're in the live webinar room and all that. And there's little highlights of each speaker and a little bit about what each speaker is all about and their experiences and a little bit about each topic as well. So go check that out, guys. EMSWebSummit.com. Still plenty of time to register, but don't wait too long. Because I hate to have too many people in, they wind up, overloading the room. So, the other thing I want to mention too, as far as the EMS Web Summit goes, at emsofficehours.com, I have a few interviews with a few of the speakers, kind of giving their take on the summit and a little bit of what they're going to be talking about. So go check that out as well. I have a few interviews over there with a couple of the speakers, and I've got one coming out tomorrow as well. So check that out at emsofficehours.com and get some of those speaker interviews there. So just about out of time, guys. Tim, thanks again for joining me. I really appreciate it.
Thanks.
And Josh, of course, thank you as always for joining me every week.
I wouldn't miss it.
All right, so guys, next week we will not have a show. I'll be skipping next week because it is Mother's Day and I will not be around. So next week we will be skipping an episode, but you can go to the Blog Talk Radio page out there and you can see some of the upcoming episodes. I put in a bunch of episodes for the next 4 weeks already preempted and ready to go. So go check those out and you can see some of the upcoming episodes.
Anybody, feel free to wish me luck. I'm running my first 10K ever. It's the Healthy Kidney 10K in Central Park, New York. And I've never run a race in my life, and I got talked into this one. So,
Oh, cool.
If you want to go to my fan page.
Don't start out too fast.
Right, yeah, exactly. Well, Josh, send me a link or whatever. I can put it in the show notes for you.
You think you're in shape, you start running fast, and later on you realize, yeah, I've got so much adrenaline going that I burn out quickly.
Yeah, I've heard that. Thank you. I will be on my best behavior to try to avoid that, to try to run within my group. So far, I've been able to maintain a 10-minute
You can get a hold of Greg Freeze, Josh. He'll give you some tips. He's run a few marathons.
Yeah, he's run a few, hasn't he?
He'll probably give you a couple of tips there.
But I'm not going to wear one of the Talon Rescue Hook t-shirts.
Yeah.
Sorry, man.
Get yourself a Want
New. Yeah, I have to get a Want New t-shirt. You're right.
All right, guys, listen, we're out of time, so let's end it there before we go too much into the wall here. Tim, thanks again for joining me. Everyone, go check out roadmatic.com, and of course, check out wantnew.com as well, and check out Josh, and check out his wrenches over there. Great oxygen wrench, great tool that every EMS provider should absolutely have. Have a good night, guys. I'll see you in 2 weeks. Well, guys, that is it for this episode. Sorry about that. Episode of EMS Office Hours. Of course, if you have some hours of your own, some topics you want to discuss, be sure to send them over to me. It's jhoffman@ems-safety.com. And until next time, this is Jim Hoffman from EMS Office Hours. And as always, stay safe.